I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Previously on The Score, Behind the Headlines.
And when they pull out his driver's license and they see the name James Jordan, they see all this stuff with Michael Jordan, they suddenly realize that they have killed Michael Jordan's dad. And they got to get rid of his body.
Most of the physical evidence that ultimately was recovered all landed on Daniel. Nothing was really linked back to Larry. As far as physical evidence.
Welcome to The Score, Behind the Headlines, Episode 4, Bad Blood. Behind the Headlines is an investigative podcast from 670 The Score. In Season 1, we're examining the 1993 murder of James Jordan. I'm Julie DeCaro with executive producer Tony Gill. If you're a fan of the much-beloved true crime staple Forensic Files, you're going to love this week's episode, because we're about to do a deep dive into the blood evidence against Daniel Green in the James Jordan murder case. Last week, we got word that Daniel Green's motion for an evidentiary hearing was denied by a North Carolina judge.
A judge in Raleigh says he won't allow a man convicted of murdering Michael Jordan's father in 1993 to move ahead with an effort to prove his innocence. Court documents available today show that Judge Winston Gilchrist told lawyers on Wednesday that he was denying Daniel Green's request for a hearing that could lead to a new trial. Green's attorney says she's filed a motion asking the judge to reconsider. She wants new testimony to be heard. She says if that's not allowed, an appeal will be filed.
That hearing was intended by Green's defense to set forth what they say is newly discovered evidence in hopes that Green would be granted a new trial. This week, we were told by Green's attorney that his motion asking the judge to reconsider his ruling was also denied. Daniel Green plans to appeal. In episode 3, we started looking at some of the evidence that points both to and away from Daniel Green's guilt, focusing primarily on the failure of the Lumberton sheriff to interview Hubert Larry Deese, the son of Robeson County Sheriff Hubert Stone and a known drug dealer. Deese was the first phone call made from the cell phone in James Jordan's car on the night of the murder, and, oh yeah, he also worked with Green's friend, Larry Demery, just a mile down the road from Gum Swamp, where James Jordan's body was discovered. We also talked about the failure of Green's trial attorney to call his alibi witnesses from the night of the murder, and the fact that the gun found in Green's grandmother's house was never actually tied to James Jordan's murder. If you missed last week's episode, you'll definitely want to go back and catch up. This week, we're going to examine one of the most explosive revelations in the prosecution's case against Daniel Green. If you think back to the previous episode, you'll remember that Daniel Green claimed that he was at a friend's barbecue when Larry Demery killed James Jordan, and that Green only later helped Demery move the body. Since his arrest back in 1993, Green has maintained that he had nothing to do with James Jordan's murder. His co-defendant, Larry Demery, on the other hand, said that it was Green who shot James Jordan in the chest at point-blank range as Jordan woke up and foiled their attempt to rob him. In exchange for his testimony against Green, his childhood friend, Demery was assured a sentence of life in prison while Green faced the death penalty.
Up into our domain. Now, what's your first name?
Daniel.
Daniel. Okay. Hey, Daniel, nice to have you sitting here.
Last episode, we said that the prosecution's case rested heavily on the premise that Larry Demery's version of events was the correct one, with little in the way of physical evidence to corroborate his claims. Here's what D.A. Johnson Britt told us last week about why the prosecution believed Demery's version of the murder over Green's.
They both start off making similar statements, and ultimately Larry Demery broke or changed his statement and then began talking in detail about how they came in contact with the car, what they were doing, how it came about, who did what, who drove the car away, where they went. Green kept up this story and then eventually it begins to change. But for him, it never changes to, oh, I was part of this. It was always someone brought us the car. It went from Larry shows up with these Continentals or Cadillacs following him. These guys get out in trench coats. This is in August, in July, in North Carolina. They look like mobsters. They tell us to get rid of the car. We get rid of the car, and the body's in the car. Then it became the same thing, that all this, you know, there are other people involved that was never, could never be proven. And then I kind of relate it to, if you remember John Lovett's character on Saturday Night Live, he was the biggest, the liar. If you don't believe that, let me tell you this. Well, that was Daniel Green. It was like he was putting stories out there. Oh, you don't believe this? Well, let me spin it this way. And so eventually he tells so many lies that anything that comes out, you know it's not going to be the truth. And so then he tries to spin this idea that he has an alibi, that Demery has done all of this by himself, and that Demery comes and gets him. But in determining who to pick in terms of which defendant, Demery's story was much more believable. Part of the evidence in this case is the alleged murder weapon was found in Daniel Green's mobile home in a canister for a shop vacuum cleaner.
So according to the prosecution, a big factor in their decision to believe Larry Demery was that Daniel Green changed his story several times. But did Larry Demery change his story too?
It changed to the extent it became more detailed. And one of the things that we dealt with, he did not really want to put himself at Mr. Jordan's car at the time Mr. Jordan was shot. He initially distanced himself, said he was some distance away. He was going back to his car to get the duct tape, because the plan was to duct tape him and then dump him on the side of the road. And then he got to the point that he was actually there and Mr. Jordan was asleep. He stirred, he started to wake up, and then Daniel Green shot him.
So at a minimum, it sounds like both Green and Demery went through several versions of what happened that night before they each settled on a story. All of this brings us to the blood evidence, or the absence of blood evidence.
Because Larry Demery testified for the prosecution that Daniel Green shot James Jordan point blank in the chest, it follows that there should be at least some blood found in Jordan's car, right? Well, that's where the case gets really weird. Here's what happened. At trial, Jennifer Elwell, a forensic scientist with the State Bureau of Investigation, testified that she found trace amounts of blood in the car, in the crack between the bottom and back of the cushion that made up the driver's seat in James Jordan's Lexus. That testimony was extremely important because it was the only physical evidence that corroborated Larry Demery's story that Daniel Green shot James Jordan while he was sitting in the driver's seat of his car. Now here's the thing. No other witnesses mentioned seeing blood in the car. That is, until Larry Demery said for the first time at trial, and only after his defense team had obtained a forensics report from the FBI, that there was blood on the driver's seat that he tried to clean off. Remember, the trial took place back in 1993, when forensics evidence was relatively new to juries and before DNA testing became more mainstream. The kind of test Elwell used to check for blood in the car was called a presumptive test, which is sort of like a preliminary test, and it requires additional testing to confirm the results. The two presumptive tests Elwell used to test the driver's seat in James Jordan's Lexus indicated the presence of blood, but the four confirmatory tests she performed to verify the finding came back negative. Making matters more complicated, the presumptive test Elwell did on the seat of the car can also indicate the presence of things other than blood, like certain chemicals, bleaches, and detergents. Secondly, Elwell did not disclose the four negative tests to the jury, meaning she only testified that the two presumptive tests indicated the presence of blood, not that her four follow-up tests did not, though she did say that one of those follow-up tests didn't yield a result. But even though Elwell got no confirmation that there was blood in the car, she drew a diagram of the seat for the jurors, drawing a red line where she says she found blood, further testifying that it was her opinion that you do have blood. Here's D.A. Johnson Britt again.
When the FBI took possession of the car, Jennifer Elwell again tested it with luminol to determine if there was blood in the car, and she too got a positive reaction for the presence of blood in the crease between the upper and lower portion of the seat. When she tested it for the phenolphthalein, she did not get the confirmatory test. And then she tried to do more detailed or extensive testing using something that was called a tachyoma test and did not get a reaction for blood. But when she testified that she conducted the luminol test, got a positive reaction, but then did not get a confirmatory response with either phenolphthalein or the tachyoma. She could not say there was or wasn't blood. Based upon the science at the time, she could say that in her opinion, based upon the luminol, that there was blood. There's possibility of blood. They removed the seats, the covering. They cut out where it was doing the testing. And eventually, it used it, whatever was there was used up in its entirety.
So not only did an expert testify before a jury that she believed there was blood in the car where James Jordan was sitting, despite the absence of a confirmatory result, she didn't mention that she got a negative result for blood in three additional tests. And she described the one confirmatory test she did disclose to the jury as not providing a conclusive result. But that's not totally accurate. See, according to one of Elwell's colleagues who provided an affidavit to the defense, the kind of test for blood Elwell used either returns a positive or negative result. There is no such thing as an inconclusive result. And even though her lab notes stated that the four confirmatory tests were negative for blood, she failed to disclose three of the four confirmatory tests, all of which were negative for blood, to the prosecution or defense. And of course, that evidence was presented to the jury in a way that at best was confusing and at worst, intentionally misleading. All of this brings us to the Swecker Report. In 2010, two former FBI agents, Chris Swecker and Mike Wolf, reviewed more than 15,000 North Carolina criminal cases following the exoneration of Greg Taylor, a man in prison 17 years for a crime he didn't commit. The Swecker Report found that the State Bureau of Investigation withheld or distorted evidence in more than 200 cases at the expense of potentially innocent defendants. One of the cases listed in the report was the People of the State of North Carolina versus Daniel Green. But former DA Johnson Britt says the Daniel Green case was included on that list as an error, and that he has an email from one of the report's authors to prove it.
When they released their report, they included the Jordan case in it as one in which the FBI had not accurately disclosed their findings. Well, after they released it, Zwecker calls me and tells me, I've made a mistake. We misread this lab report, and we should not have included it in our report as being one of the cases in which there was a bad report. He sends me an email, which I still have today, that's included in part of the response that I filed to their initial motion for appropriate relief, because it was all based on the blood, that was a mistake. When the Zwecker report was released, everybody was afraid that it was going to say, oh, there's someone on death row that's been identified in a case, and it shouldn't have been, they shouldn't be there. Well, the headline was this case, Daniel Green, Jordan murder case identified in Zwecker report. So it really got blown out of proportion, and they admit they made a mistake.
We've seen this email. Here's what it says.
Dear Dr. Britt, as you are aware, former FBI Assistant Director Mike Wolf and I recently completed an independent review of the North Carolina SBI forensic laboratory serology testing procedures at the request of Attorney General Roy Cooper. Based on that review, a final report was issued that listed 230 laboratory cases that contained serology test reports that either failed to mention the negative or inconclusive results of one or more confirmatory tests or reported results that were inconsistent with the lab analyst's notes contained in the lab file. This is to inform you that a case prosecuted by your office was mistakenly included in Category 3 of the report. This case involves Larry Martin Demery and Daniel Andre Green. The lab report stated examination and analysis of the front passenger seat item 59A from the Lexus, item 59, gave chemical indications for the presence of blood. Further analysis failed to give conclusive results. Lab notes reflect 4 inconclusive Takayama tests were conducted. Our review did not pick up on the second sentence, which qualifies the results stated in the first sentence. If this sentence had been noted in our review, the cases would not have been included in the report. Although the words further tests versus further analysis would have provided more clarity to the reader, the phrase further analysis failed to give conclusive results does alert the reader that the initial test results are not conclusive. For this reason, the lab report did not meet our criteria for inclusion in our final list of questionable cases. If you have any questions or need further clarification, please contact me.
In 2014, an investigator for Daniel Green's defense team met with Jennifer Elwell, who stated that if she had to testify today, she would say that she does not know if there was blood present in James Jordan's car or not.
There are plenty of other questions about the forensic examination of James Jordan's car. For example, Elwell also testified that she examined the entire interior of James Jordan's car, and the only place she found the presence of blood was in the crack between the top and bottom of the driver's seat, which was pressed up against James Jordan's back. But there was no exit wound on James Jordan, and no blood was found on the steering wheel or dashboard immediately opposite where he was shot in the chest. And Larry Demery testified at trial that he and Green moved James Jordan to the passenger seat before driving away in his car. Demery even said he got some of James Jordan's blood on his arm when he moved the body. So if there was enough blood present from the gunshot wound to get onto Larry Demery's arm, why wasn't there any blood anywhere else in the car? And one last thing. For reasons still unknown, the prosecution asked the court, outside the presence of the defense, to have the only known sample of James Jordan's blood, which was in the possession of the SBI, be destroyed shortly after Daniel Green's conviction, but while his case was still on appeal. In addition, the blood Jennifer Elwell says she found in James Jordan's car was all used up by forensic testing. As a result, there was no way for the defense to subject any of the blood to confirmatory or DNA testing of their own. Here's the Washington Post's Kyle Swenson.
So you have a state expert who's testifying that there's blood in the car in this case. And this was kind of in the early days of DNA and forensic evidence, when really it was kind of like, I think a lot of juries and just American citizens were kind of shocked by the idea, like, oh, scientifically, there's no way to get around this evidence. Like, we hadn't really seen the problems with forensics that would later crop up, get publicized as much. So, you know, if a state expert comes up there and says, oh, yeah, there's blood in the car, of course the jury is going to be like, okay, there must be blood in the car, which helps the prosecution's version of the case or theory. But the fact that then later you find out that there's such rampant problems and errors at this particular state lab and with the state agency is incredibly shocking, particularly this particular forensics expert. So it was Jennifer Elwell. Later, you know, in 2011, honestly said that she now would not testify the same way, that she didn't really know if there was blood in the car.
Then there's the puzzling matter of the shirt James Jordan was wearing at the time of his death. We'll let Kyle Swenson explain.
So, you know, James Jordan was shot through his chest. Through his upper, like right by his heart, I believe, like the left side of his body. And in the initial coroner's report, there's no hole in his shirt. Now, there are holes, there's like 2 holes down below, like on the lower part of his shirt, I guess, like by his stomach. So that kind of supports the idea that if he was, when he was shot, maybe his shirt was kind of like jacked up or like pulled up around his chest. And that's where those 2 holes were from the bullet. But In the initial report, there's no hole at the top. And then also, like, the chain of custody with this shirt is crazy. Because I don't know if you... I forgot if I wrote this part in or if we didn't report it out. But if you read the legal documents in the filings, the chain of custody is that at one point, this shirt was being held by a guy who... It was in the custody of this guy who worked for the company that transported Jordan's body. And he didn't like how the shirt smelled, so he buried it in his backyard. And then later, they realized this shirt is probably a critical piece of evidence in this incredibly huge murder investigation, which you'll probably get it. They dig the shirt up out of this guy's backyard, resubmit it, and then later, when it's examined again a second time, that's when the hole appears for the first time in a report. So Green's attorneys have rightfully pointed out that that's so suspicious that he, first there's no hole, thing gets buried underground for a couple days, it gets retrieved, resubmitted to this different lab, and this different lab finds a hole. Additionally, this hole is important about it being in the chest because this prosecution's whole account of the murder is that Jordan was sleeping in his car, and so he was just shot by Green through the chest. This, though, the actual evidence, if you believe that the hole wasn't there and that there was a hole, the two holes at the bottom are where the bullet was from, shows that it was some type of struggle, maybe, or, you know, something different happened than him just lying in the car. If that makes sense.
So let's back up. If you remember, James Jordan's body wasn't found anywhere near Lumberton, North Carolina, where he was shot. It was actually found in a swamp, gum swamp, in South Carolina, about a mile down the road from where Larry Demery and Larry Deese worked at Crestline Mobile Homes. When James Jordan's body was first discovered, it was handed over to a part-time coroner in Cumberland County who didn't have a refrigeration unit. A Dr. Joel Sexton performed an autopsy on the body, in which he noted specifically that there was no hole in James Jordan's shirt that corresponded with the bullet hole in his chest. And he said in his report that he took time to look for one. Dr. Sexton also wrote, directly below that location in the lower abdominal region are three holes that would line up with the hole in the chest if the shirt were pulled up approximately 1 foot. Once the autopsy was complete, Jordan's body was cremated, with the coroner preserving only the hands and jaws for future identification. But prior to moving the body, Dr. Sexton removed James Jordan's shirt, washed it, and gave it to an employee of a company called Palmetto Professional Services, which transported bodies to funeral homes. The employee, who was bothered by the smell of the shirt, took it home to his house and buried it in his yard. Now, if you watch a lot of crime shows, you know that establishing a chain of custody where law enforcement can verify where a piece of evidence has been and that it's in the same condition it was when it was recovered every step of the way during an investigation. It's extremely important to the prosecution's case because if a chain of custody is not established, it opens up law enforcement to claims of tampering with or contamination of evidence. Obviously, maintaining a solid chain of custody was not front and center in anyone's mind at this point. Later on in the investigation, law enforcement determined that the shirt was an important piece of evidence and sent a South Carolina investigator to the employee's home to dig up the shirt. And when the shirt was turned over to the SBI lab for examination, Agent R.N. Mars reported the presence of a bullet hole that corresponded exactly with the chest wound inflicted on James Jordan. According to the defense, Agent Mars found the hole right where Dr. Sexton said he looked for a hole and didn't find one. And in case you're wondering about the two other holes at the bottom of the shirt, they were still there. So now we have at least three holes in the shirt James Jordan was wearing at the time of his death. And we've got only two possibilities here. Number one, Dr. Sexton simply missed a bullet hole that he said he specifically took time looking for. Or two, the hole in the shirt mysteriously appeared sometime between the time Dr. Sexton performed the autopsy and the time it made its way to the SBI lab in North Carolina. But Daniel Green's trial attorneys, Angus Thompson and Woodbury Bowen, failed to point out the discrepancies in the two reports to the jury. They never brought up the fact that the bullet hole observed by Agent Mars was not found by Dr. Sexton in the initial autopsy. Worse, Green's defense team never called a ballistics expert to testify, either regarding the various holes in the shirt or about the gun found in the shop vac in Green's grandmother's home. Here's GQ's Scott Rabb, who you heard from back in episode 2, on Green's lead trial attorney, Angus Thompson.
Angus was way over his head. I know what you. I love public defenders are heroes to me and to my wife, who's a legal journalist. I didn't mean to cut you off, but Angus was a very passive attorney.
So if you're keeping score at home, you've probably figured out by now that outside of Larry Demery's testimony, there's no real evidence that Daniel Green was the one who shot James Jordan in the chest. If you take Jennifer Elwell's affidavit at face value, that she now doesn't know if there was blood in James Jordan's car, there's no evidence to show that he was shot in his car at all. In fact, outside of Demery's testimony, there's no evidence that James Jordan was even on the side of the road when Demery says he was, or that's where he was murdered. Everything hinges on the testimony of Larry Demery, who struck a deal with the prosecution to avoid the death penalty. And one other note before we move on to other issues in the next episode. Witnesses gave evidence after Green's conviction in 1996 that Larry Demery had confessed to being the one who murdered James Jordan. The first is a woman named Connie Brayboy, who was the editor-in-chief of the Carolina Indian Voice, a newspaper aimed at Native Americans out of nearby Pembroke, North Carolina. Connie was friends with Larry Demery's mother, Virginia, and she says that during a conversation with Demery shortly after his arrest, Demery told her that it was he, not Daniel Green, who killed James Jordan. Further, Brayboy says Demery never gave any indication he intended to blame Daniel Green for the murder. She didn't publish Demery's confession, though, because she was afraid of upsetting his mother. We reached out to Connie Brayboy on Facebook, and she told us she'd be willing to come on the podcast. But since then, we've been unable to get back in touch with her. So, Connie, if you're listening, we'd still love to hear what you have to say. A man by the name of Jason Matthew Sams is the second person. He said that Demery told him he killed James Jordan and that he testified against Daniel in fear of receiving the death penalty and that Daniel had nothing to do with the murder except for helping to get rid of the body. There was another man, William Cruz. He stated that Larry Demery boasted about killing Michael Jordan's father. There was another individual who was briefly incarcerated with Demery, Marcus Devon Carrington, who also spoke with Demery when they were both housed in the Foothills Correctional Institute. He says Demery bragged about killing James Jordan like it was only a game. And he said he meant to kill Jordan and never talked about Mr. Green taking part in the murder of Mr. Jordan. All these witnesses to Larry Demery's alleged confessions came forward following the trial and Daniel Green's convictions. So the defense had no opportunity to put them in front of a jury. And without a new trial for Daniel Green, it's doubtful any jury will hear what they have to say. Next time on The Score Behind the Headlines. Make sure you stay after the post credits for a very special announcement for next week's episode. The Score Behind the Headlines is written and researched by Julie DeCaro and is executive produced by me, Tony Gill. New episodes are posted every Monday of each week on radio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Julie DeCaro, at TonyGill670, and at 670TheScore. Hello, BTH fans. This is executive producer of The Score Behind the Headlines, Tony Gill. First of all, I have to say is thank you. Thank you for your support, your listening. Julie and I really appreciate all the feedback and subscriptions and 5-star ratings that we received from everyone. And we hope you guys stick with us through this season and the seasons to come. But we are pausing here because we know you guys have a lot of questions about this case because we've been getting them from you left and right since episode one. So next week, here's what we're going to do. We're going to dedicate at least part of the episode to answering as many of the questions as we can. You can start off by emailing them to us at 670behindtheheadlines@gmail.com. That's 670behindtheheadlines@gmail.com. Or you can DM them to me or Julie. Julie's on Twitter at Julie DeCaro, and I'm on Twitter at TonyGill670. Our DMs are open, so you can go there as well. Later this week, we're hoping to have a phone line set up that will allow you guys to leave your questions via voicemail so we can get those in as well, so we can hear your voice live on the podcast. So make sure you keep an eye on our social media. When that is ready available, we will tweet that out and have it ready for you guys so you can be on next week's episode of The Scores Behind the Headlines. Again, thank you guys. Thank you. Thank you. The support has been very overwhelming, and we really want to continue to do this for you guys, and we hope you are enjoying it. So thanks a lot again. We will see you next week on The Score Behind the Headlines.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.